I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome back to Radio Times. 2 years ago, after a tough day at work, Linda Tirado fired off a response to a question in an online forum that asked, why do poor people do things that seem so self-destructive? Her response, why I make terrible decisions or poverty thoughts, went viral and was published in the Huffington Post, The Atlantic, The Nation, read by millions of people. She and her husband were working three low-wage jobs at the time, raising two kids, struggling to pay their rent, and making what she called a lot of poor financial decisions. Tirado has expanded on that personal essay in her book, Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. And she joins us on Radio Times to tell us her story, to debunk some stereotypes about poor people and explain why it's so tough to get out of poverty. And Linda Tirado, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm happy to be here.
So how much has that or did that essay change your life?
Well, I write books now, which is an amazing career to have. And I've been lucky, to kind of travel around quite substantially talking to people about what does the economy feel like to you and how does it impact your life and what sorts of decisions and calculations are you having to make and what are you giving up, to put food on the table for your family and what does that actually look like? So it's been incredible. It's just been absolutely incredible.
I mean, would you say that essay got you out of poverty at least temporarily or for now?
Bill Maher actually personally welcomed me to the working class on air. So I feel like we can safely say that.
And I'm curious about the kinds of responses that you got. As I said, you know, and this was a couple of years ago, millions of people read it. And did your response, did those responses give you a kind of a Rorschach about how people think about poor people in this country?
That's actually how I wrote the book, is I took the most hateful responses from that initial piece and just answered those questions. You know, here is how we dare have sex, and here is how we dare have children, and here is why I dare sometimes go on a date, and here is why sometimes I am not happy and I don't feel as though I need to perform happiness for everybody that crosses my path, and, you know, all of those things. But the response was actually very, very shocking.
Shocking because it was so hateful?
Yeah, and also so supportive. I mean, it's the internet and it was viral, so it's, you know what I mean? Like, it's a mass of both extremes.
Yes, we experience that every day on this program. I'm curious, though, and you do write about the, you know, a little bit about how you became poor, if I can put it that way. Sounds like you were born into a middle class family, had some bad luck, maybe made a couple of bad decisions. How did you end up in poverty?
My husband had just come home from Iraq and we'd gotten pregnant with our first child. I'd left home at 16 after I graduated high school. So I'd always been kind of, you know, lower working class like you are when you get out on your own at 16 and make promptly all of the good decisions you would expect a teenager to make on their own.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, we were starting to climb out of that. And he'd just come home from Iraq. We found ourselves pregnant. We moved to Cincinnati on the GI Bill. And then the paperwork didn't come through and didn't come through and didn't come through. And so we both wound up working at a Burger King part-time. It was all we could find. And then we had a flood in the apartment we had managed to get on our wages. And it destroyed everything we owned. And bam, there you are. You own nothing. You have a child due in 2 weeks. You've just been evicted for non-payment of rent on an apartment that you can't live in. And you are both working at Burger King. Well, and welcome to poverty. And it's that easy.
Well, and you make a distinction, interestingly, between what is thought of as generational poverty and situational poverty. And it sounds like what you and your husband were experiencing was a more situational kind of poverty.
Absolutely. I do not come out of generational poverty. I'm the textbook example of situational. And what's interesting, actually, is the vast majority of Americans will experience situational poverty at some point in their lives. Most people who are in the working classes, the lower, you know, kind of in the service industry section of the working classes, will experience, like, situational poverty somewhere between 5 and 6 times over the course of their life. This is something that hits seniors. It hits young people. I mean, you miss a paycheck and have a car wreck in the same 2 weeks, and it might be game over. You know, 2/3 of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. That means that if they miss a paycheck, the whole thing comes crashing down. So it's really easy to get yourself into these situations. And I think one of the troubles we have with policy in this country is we don't think of ourselves as being in poverty when we are, because it's not that kind of 10-year lifetime, never been to school, never had a leg up anywhere in your life kind of poverty that we like to define as poverty, right? And we like to differentiate ourselves from that. And the different side, the distinction I like to draw is, hey, I might have had it rough, but honey, I am reasonably young, I am reasonably intelligent, I am reasonably well-educated, I am white, I am able-bodied, I am, you know, married to a man, I have all of these privileges, and it still sucked so hard for me that 12 million people were like, yeah, that's it. So if it sucks that hard for me with as much privilege as I have, let's take a look at what it looks like to come out of generational poverty, and who are we blaming and why?
Well, and do you feel, as you said, this article and now a book, and you're clearly a writer now, but do you feel like you could slip back in poverty? The fact that you experienced it once, you feel vulnerable to poverty again?
I don't think anybody comes out of it and isn't aware that it's right behind them. Right. I've talked to a lot of people who've, you know, worked their way up or been handed magic like I was, but whatever, they're in a different situation now than they were before, and each and every single one of us is very well aware it could be tomorrow. But no, I'm not afraid of it, because you have to understand that was my entire adult life. For 15 years, I worked in the service industry. What's frightening is suddenly not having a job to go to. And having all of these decisions of this entirely new, like, class of people that I'd barely met in my entire life, and suddenly you have to perform like them without that 15 years of backing, without the alma mater, without the, you know, networks and all of the things that you build up over a normal middle-class adulthood. That's the frightening thing, is to get stuck in a situation you know nothing about. It's not actually that frightening of, well, I'll go back to something that I know is kind of, you know, legitimately awful, but at least you know how to handle it, right? Like, there's a routine to it.
And this is something different. You describe what it's like to work in the service industry, and both you and your husband were working a couple of jobs at one point, making, what, $8 to $9 an hour. One of the things that I think people don't understand is that in many of these jobs, the employees are not in control of their schedule, that's one of the things that can kind of change on a dime. And the thought of, I guess, being available for an $8 or $9 hour job can be very taxing, very stressful.
Yeah, actually, and we know how stressful it is. If you are listening and you're reasonably middle class, or it's been a very long time since you've been in poverty and you think you might have forgotten, here's an experiment for you. It's like 11 o'clock in the morning. Don't sleep tonight. Don't sleep tomorrow night. On that third day, go to work and tell me how well you're doing. That's the physical and mental barriers that somebody who's working in the service industry juggling those two jobs, that's what they live with every single day of their life. And so, you know, that's the big difference that I see. It's a huge physical impact. It's a huge psychological impact because, like, okay, so I'm working at Burger King, right? I am a Marine's wife who is carrying his first child, and I had a woman come up to me and say, have you ever just thought about getting a better job?
And what do you say to someone?
No, I had never thought of that. No, this was my initial response, is always snark. Like, no, actually, I hadn't considered that. Where would I go for a better job? You tell me. Where do I go? Where's the job line? Where's the store that I just go to and queue up for the good jobs that my dad had when he worked at DuPont for 35 years and retired? You show me where the good jobs are. I want one of those. I'll stand in line for I don't know how long for a decent job. You know, and so it's those sorts of things, that kind of constant people looking down on you, people assuming you're stupid, people being absolutely willing to ask you things that they would consider horrifyingly rude to ask their own friends. You would never go into an office and say, has it occurred to you that you could just not have sex with your spouse and then you wouldn't have kids you couldn't afford? And you would never walk into somebody's workplace and do that, but we see that in the service industry constantly.
And, you know, I want to make sure our listeners understand. So your husband served in the Iraq War. He's a veteran of the Iraq
War. He's a Marine. Yeah.
And still unable, he was not able to get a job outside of the service industry?
No, because he was going to school full-time at the time. I mean, we'd moved to Cincinnati to go on his GI Bill so that he would be a full-time student, and we'd have that living stipend, and we'd be covered for my daughter's birth. So that had been the plan. And then when the school money came through, the tuition was paid, but the living stipend never came. So there's our income. And he had to go get, you know, whatever job was close to home and school that would work with his hours. And it was Burger King, the Burger King that I was working at, actually. Hmm.
Should we feel sorry? Should we have felt sorry for you, Linda?
Never. Never, because I had it so good compared to everybody else. Honey, I had a husband who loved me and was by my side. I had a beautiful family. I had friends. I had a job. Hell, I had two jobs. Sometimes I've had three. Do you know how many people can't even find one? Mm-hmm. I mean, no, you don't feel sorry for, because we are not objects to be pitied. We are hardworking Americans, just like everybody else. Who you should feel sorry for are the people whose eyes are so closed that they think it appropriate to walk up to a service worker and insult them under the guise of friendliness and helpfulness. Who you should feel sorry for are the people running the country who can't be fussed to ever talk to us about what policies we might need to actually change our lives for the better, what systemic help we might have. Sorry doesn't enter into it. You should feel responsible. Everybody in America should feel responsible for the fact that 45 million Americans live in poverty. We are one of the wealthiest countries in the world. There is no excuse for that. You know, in Salt Lake City, they solved homelessness and their empty housing crisis in one fell swoop by just giving the houses to homeless people. There are solutions. There are common sense solutions that work for everybody. If we could only get the collective will, if we should feel sorry for anybody, it is collectively ourselves for failing as a nation to take care of this giant, huge systemic problem. In Baltimore, during the riots, they canceled school without warning. And in Baltimore, there were certain neighborhoods that so many kids were on free lunch that a community service, it's called Op Help or Hush. You can find it on Twitter. It's at Op Help or Hush. Mm-hmm. Actually had to step in and start providing lunches. And now they have what they call Baltimore lunch, and it's spread to St. Louis, and now it's STL lunch. But the fact that individuals are having to step up and provide food for an entire school full of children because the state didn't think about it, because those programs didn't exist, that says something about our society, and it says something about how we should consider ourselves. We have the potential to be the greatest nation in the entire world, and we are failing every day to live up to it. So I think if we should feel sorry for anybody, it's the people who haven't understood how much work we have ahead of us.
Well, then we need to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. In fact, I'm looking at something you wrote, what a real anti-poverty movement looks like, and I want to pick up on that. But first, a very quick reintroduction. Linda Tirado is our guest, and we're talking about her book, her memoir. It's called Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America, and it's about the time that she and her husband and her children were living in poverty. We want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I see some Facebook comments as well. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Linda Tirado. Again, the title of her book is Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America, and it's about both her own experiences and the experiences of the millions of, or some of the millions of people living in this country who are living in poverty, how tough it is to get out of poverty these days. A bunch of people want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Linda, I'm looking at this piece that you wrote, and I'll just quote a sentence here. An anti-poverty movement led by the middle and upper classes is doomed to failure. How come?
Because the middle and upper classes have absolutely no idea what's needed to solve the problems of the working and impoverished classes. Because those are such opposing ideas. And it's the thing that I've really gotten to it's a thing that I've really gotten to understand, kind of having seen the differences. There's a lot of things that I thought before that I found were maybe uncharitable or untrue, things that I've gotten more perspective on. But one thing I know is that if you get a room full of rich people together, they will throw some money at a problem, or they will come up with a commission, or they'll come up with a program, and they very rarely ask anybody who's actually in that impacted community. And so then what you wind up with is a movement full of really great ideas that are doomed to failure because they weren't checked for basic function. Things like, okay, we're going to have a job training program. Now, in order to get this benefit, you have to attend this resume class. And to get to the resume class, you have to have 100% perfect attendance, even if it means calling out of work and losing your job, which is a choice I was confronted with once. Of, well, do you want this program? Because if you do, we need you to quit your job so that you can come to the resume writing class so that we can help you find work. And when you have programs that work like that, you have a movement doomed to failure.
Would a solution then be just taking the minimum wage and making it closer to a living wage, which is just literally to pay people more money? I mean, if it were $15 as opposed to $8 or $9 an hour, that would get a lot of people out of poverty. Would that be a fix?
It's not a fix. It's a good working. It's a good move towards a solution. But the problem wasn't caused by low wages. The problem was caused by low wages and a lack of access to health care and no universal child care and a slow cutting away of all of the things that we as a society used to do for our citizenry and a pushing of responsibility onto a certain group of people, which is to say the people that are working and actually creating all of the profits, right? As we come to a more stratified society, we find bigger and bigger problems because we are creating a larger and larger underclass. So you can raise the wage, and that's all well and good, mm-hmm. but then you're going to come to a point where if we're only creating jobs in the service industry, where if a third of our economy is there right now, and it's looking like it's going to be more, and if we're only creating those kind of, you know, jobs that you don't need a college education for, that you don't need specialized training for outside of on-the-job training, it's going to become unsustainable for employers to pay those wages. Look, you can't sell dollar cheeseburgers in rural Utah and pay somebody $15 an hour. You can't do it.
So
it's never going to work as a business model. So what we need to do is collectively figure out, okay, great, if we're all going to win, if we're going to have this kind of prosperous society, if we're going to have this kind of stratified society, then what do we need to put in place as far as the social fabric, as far as the social contract, as far as the civic responsibility that we all have as Americans? What do we owe each other to make this country prosperous? And not just individuals in this country who happen to have been extraordinarily lucky and also extraordinarily talented, but everybody.
Well, would that be starting, and people have talked about this, it's not necessarily easy to institute, which is a good education, good schools for all children in this country.
That's absolutely key. Yes, absolutely. That's the first bit. In fact, it goes before that. Early childhood education, daycare that isn't ridiculously expensive to the point that you're having to make a choice between a good daycare provider that's going to nurture your child and somebody that you can afford.
And what we hear from the president, and we're hearing from others as well, talking about the importance of daycare or early childhood education so that all children get a good jump start on academic achievement and the things that come after that.
Yes. I mean, look, we know that early childhood, everything impacts the rest of your life. Every stage of your life impacts the rest of your life, right? And we know that that from that very, very beginning, it's hugely important. The point to me isn't necessarily any specific program, because there isn't going to be a single program you're going to come to me with that I'm not going to say that's absolutely part of the solution.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
Everything is part of the solution. The point is, how do we make them all function? How do we stop it from being a pastiche and a patchwork and a system that only works for some people some of the time? How do we make sure that a Marine does not come home from war and then not get his GI Bill? How do we fix that problem? That's a solvable problem. How do we fix it?
Well, and interesting, in this piece that you wrote, What a Real Anti-Poverty Movement Looks Like, you have criticisms of Occupy Wall Street, a look like a bunch of confused, disaffected youth. You also criticize the Tea Party movement as a bunch of angry baby boomers. So they don't, from your perspective, they don't speak for you?
No, neither of them do. Look, I'm a liberal from Utah, which means I am the liberal queen inside my state lines. The second I leave, I'm a bit of a center-right moderate.
Right? I get you, right.
You know, the Tea Party, no, the Tea Party doesn't connect with me because they're talking about the friggin' gold standard, aren't they? And Occupy doesn't connect with me because I don't actually have a whole lot in common with leftist anarchist types. And I appreciate that wasn't all of Occupy,
sure.
But it was a big enough chunk that I'm not going to feel connected. We are not going to get a coherent anti-poverty movement until there is space for people that are rural, until there is space for people that are conservative and liberal. The reason I don't connect with any of these camps is because if you're talking about the working classes, you are talking about so many millions of people, they are going to be on the right and the left. You cannot have an anti-poverty movement. You cannot have a workers' movement that is a partisan movement.
In fact, you say it needs to be apartisan, not bipartisan, but apartisan and pragmatic.
Right. And that's exactly it. We need solutions that work. We can get consensus from the right and the left around solutions that work. And if we do that, then we make that change. But as long as we have these litmus tests of, you know, take, for example, gay marriage. That's a recent one. Okay, so as long as we go, I'm not willing to work with you on getting workers' oven mitts until I know how you feel about gay marriage. That's not to devalue the importance of marriage equality. That's not to devalue the importance of the LGBT community, right? But it is to say oven mitts are an apartisan issue. Every worker in America should have proper safety equipment, and I don't care how you feel about any divisive issue. That is a true statement. So let's get that done. The workers, the class movement, cannot be partisan. It does not belong to the left or the right. My friends who are far on the right are working just as hard at jobs that are just as terrible and circumstances that are just as awful as my friends that are on the hard left.
Let me reintroduce you, and that's Linda Tirado, and we are talking about poverty, how tough it can be to get out of poverty. She's written a book called Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. Linda, it looks like a lot of people want to talk to you. We have just we have just a few open lines here at 1-888-477-9499. I also see a bunch of email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Let me get, looks like Angela from Doylestown to join us. Angela, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
First, I want to thank Linda, your husband. Thank you for his service to our country. I wanted to comment on something you said a little earlier about the lunch program in Baltimore that was impacted due to the riots. And I got the sense that there was a little negative view in terms of the fact that it was just private citizens who had to step in and assist when the state program was not available. And I kind of looked at that as a real positive, showing that, you know, people in the community see a need and will, without the government directing them or coming up with a program, fill that need.
Well, Angela, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Linda, you want to respond to that? I mean, on the one hand, it does represent a response from a community, but I think you're also saying something else. Go ahead, Linda.
Yeah. I mean, look, I would never I know the guy that runs it. His name's Charles Wade. He's got partners. She's named Tasha. They're amazing people. They are fantastic, wonderful people. I wish everybody was like them. What shouldn't have to happen is that fantastic, amazing, wonderful people have to drop their lives for 2 solid weeks to administer a program that the state should have been administering to begin with, that we have all paid our taxes to administer, that was guaranteed to those parents. That's more where you're, if you're hearing that kind of negativity, that's where it's coming from. I have zero problem with people stepping up. We need that. That's the only way we survive. What I want to see is when people step up, we have the big philanthropic organizations and the government going, oh my God, that program's going like gangbusters. Let's do that.
Hmm.
Instead of saying, hey, let's make up a program that looks sort of like this instead of going with what we know works. Or instead of testing it, if that makes sense.
Andil, appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me find out what Mary from Pennington has to say. And Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I had two questions. I don't have the benefit of having read your book. Thank you for writing it. Mm-hmm. I really liked Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickel and Dime.
Oh, she's amazing, isn't she?
Well, and she has the foreword to this book, just to add to your comment there, Mary. Go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, two issues. And one is I was really struck by your comment at the beginning of the program that you had received some hateful responses. And I found myself wondering, why do people, why is there such hatred of poor people or people in dire circumstances these days? The second question I had was, I would like to know what would have helped you and your family specifically. What would have given you a leg up or helped you in any way? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Two very good questions, Maria. Sure. Thanks for calling in. So why so hateful, do you think, Linda?
Well, three things, actually. The first one, John Steinbeck, I'm going to butcher this quote. There are no poor people in America. There are only temporarily embarrassed millionaires. And that's really where it's at, where nobody actually wants to identify as poor. Poor is those trashy people next to you. Right. And we do that. Even when I was living in the trailer park, you'd hear one neighbor saying, well, you know, I might live in a trailer, but at least I ain't got four kids, you know, and everybody needs to feel better. It's very high school of us, but that's, you know, human society of we feel better when we see something to compare ourselves to. And because in America, we value ourselves based on what we have in our bank, that is the stigma, that is the attachment that we use. And when we see people doing things and we say, we would never do that, we would act better, we're making a moral judgment. So once you've done that, you've decided these people are immoral and they're lazy and they're stupid and they're just not getting ahead because anybody can get ahead in America, right? That's America, right? That's where the hate comes in of how dare you demand anything from me when you're the leech on society. And what you have to remind folks of is, honey, it don't make a bit of difference whether you're taking a 3-martini lunch and writing that off of your taxes or whether you're taking food stamps. Either way, the federal government's paying for your lunch. You know, actually, the one difference, the 3-martini lunch is going to taste better and be better food. So who's the leech? So that's really kind of where we try to kind of flip those class conceptions on their head. But we all take money from the government. We all take benefit from the government. So why is this group uniquely demonized?
But let me pick up on that. Do you think in some way it's about fear that everyone in, whether they're conscious of it or not, are afraid that they could end up poor too?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I also think that if you set up a society in which everybody is competing for resources, you're not going to set up a society that's necessarily going to be terribly collective about how they feel about their fellow man. If you have groups of people like we do in this society that think the other guy is out to get you and what's yours, you're not going to feel charitable or inclined to help them. Right. So it's a societal adjustment. The second question you had was what would have helped us? I'll tell you what would have helped us. We would have been helped by a system that worked the way it said it did. That is the worst part of being poor or working class or in poverty or whatever level of not enough you're at. The worst part is that nothing ever looks like it says it does. I was just in St. Louis over the weekend, and I was hanging out with some folks. They needed to pick up some money at Western Union. They drove around for 3.5 hours trying to find a Western Union to pick this money up from, had to borrow gas money to get to a Western Union to get the money. By the time they were done, they were supposed to pick up $50. They wound up with $35, and it cost them 3 hours and $15 to get $35. That is what it's like to be poor in America. There is no convenience. There are no services tailored to you. There's only what people give you begrudgingly. The people like Baltimore Lunch, like Charles and those guys, those are the rare ones that come to you and say, how can we help? And they mean it. Not how can I make you not starve so I don't have to feel guilty about you, but how can I help?
Linda, let me read an email from Jill. She says, this is about you. She's bright and articulate, very surprising. She was not able to work somewhere other than Burger King. Were there no jobs to be had where she was, or was she not able to secure the open position?
There were no jobs, and there still are for a lot of people no jobs. The thing is, in the service industry, nobody cares how smart you are. They don't want you to be smart. SMART is for jobs where you need to think. In the service industry, you're given a script and told how to behave and how to dress and how to speak and how to walk and when you're allowed to go to the bathroom. It's actually a disadvantage to be much of a thinker when that's what you do for a living. And beyond that, like, look, this was 2010,
right.
2009, 2010. There were no jobs anywhere. I was lucky to get the one I got, and I sweet-talked my way into that one, I bet you.
Thanks for that email. And something else that you raise in your book, and I know this always gets raised with people who are low income, about having a flat screen TV, about having a microwave, about having a cell phone. How do you answer that?
I think it's really interesting when people tell me I'm not wearing my hair shirt properly. And I would also like to hear the moral reasoning behind somebody who says nobody is allowed a nice thing ever. I just explained to me, and this is what actually started it all off, is that initially somebody said I was dressed at the grocery store. I saw a poor person with food stamps and an iPhone. Tell me why I'm not supposed to be mad. Here are five reasons off the top of my head. How do you know that they didn't get it free with a two-year sign-up? How do you know it wasn't issued to them by their job? How do you know it wasn't issued to them by their school? How do you know they're not borrowing it from a friend or a family member while they're running an errand for them? How do you know it wasn't a gift from a family member? How do you know they didn't save up for 3 years and finally splurge on that one nice thing at Christmas? How do you come to a judgment about what somebody else owns or does not own from your snapshot of their life? Now, you want to break it down economically, you buy that big screen TV. Consumer goods and electronics are cheap as hell in America these days. That's a couple of $100 max at the pawn shop, all right? $200, you're going to get hundreds, thousands of hours of entertainment out of that device, all right? Is that wiser or less wise than going to the movies or doing any other number of things that would be more expensive? And before you come at me and say, why do you need entertainment at all? I will say, why are you human? We know humans need to be entertained. They need to be loved. They need to feel connection. There's this thing called Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and you cannot be a full human being under this like psychological theory unless you've managed to hit all of these rungs to self-actualization. Poor people are on the second rung. We've managed in most cases like shelter and food. We're working on community and society and love and belonging and acceptance. And if those are the things you're working on, honey, sometimes you can watch some TV with your husband at the end of the day without somebody coming in and asking you to justify it to him.
Well, Linda, hold on, because we have to take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Linda Tirado, our guest, stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Talking with Linda Tirado. Her book is called Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. Some interesting research that came out not so long ago from the University of California, that's a Berkeley Labor Research Center, saying that most of the people who qualify for things like food stamps and subsidized health care and subsidized child care, the earned income tax credit, even other safety net programs, have a job or they're in a family with working parents. And we're talking about what Linda's life has been like and what she has learned as she has talked to people across the country about how we feel about poor people in this country. Also, some ideas about how to get out of poverty. And we have a lot of people who want to join the conversation. 1-888-477-9499. I'll read some tweets and emails in just a moment or two. Let me get Suma from Princeton to join us. Suma, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I just want to commend Linda for speaking exactly the things that our congressmen are supposed to be listening to in terms of addressing the needs of poverty. Because many a time they tend to go on the extreme, go to the extreme left, which is more idealistic than realistic, and then you go to the extreme right, which is more wickedness and hatredness for others because they have been lucky enough to be successful and think that all others are stupid. So she is speaking on from the centrist point of view, and I really, really, really look forward to reading her book, and I really hope congressmen are listening to what she has to say, and I look forward to the opportunity of her being called to Congress to address them about how they should look at issues when it comes to addressing poverty in America. Thank you, Linda.
Suma, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Linda, picking up on what Suma just said, do you get involved in politics? I mean, we're now in the throes of a presidential campaign. Seems like it's going to go on forever. But are you looking at candidates, listening to candidates, trying to figure out who has the best ideas related to poverty?
Oh, absolutely. And more than that, I will absolutely happily work for any candidate that I think is going to be good. Unfortunately for me, most of my candidates are either on the hard right or the hard left. So, you know, that kind of puts paid to me because one of the things that I value is comity. In Congress, one of the things that I value is an ability to get along and work with the people that you've been sent to work with as though you are adults. I don't see an awful lot of that in either of the fields on any side. There are a few here and there. But, you know, I'm not looking to get involved in politics personally as a candidate, if that's what you're asking. Those people spend 4 hours a day dialing to fundraise so that they can keep their jobs 2 weeks or 2 years later. They're running constant campaigns, and quite frankly, I can't think of anything that would be worse than being a United States congressperson.
Well, and I think Suma wants you to testify before Congress somewhere. I don't know whether anyone's approached you or not.
I've been in conversations. Jan Schakowsky was really great. I talked to her when she was doing her food stamp challenge. I was just on Keith Ellison's podcast. He's a really cool dude. I actually went to Paul Ryan's poverty hearings in 2014. That was really interesting. You know, I'm absolutely fascinated by it. It's just that I don't think I can wait for Congress to fix it because Congress has largely been the problem and governments have largely been the problem. And they're the ones setting this tone. They're the ones allowing this tone to exist and not coming out strongly against it. So, you know, I trust them as far as I think they can be trusted, which is to say they're in charge and I'm certainly going to listen to what they have to say. But then I'm probably going to go, you know, talk to my own people and say, OK, what do we want to have happen and then have them go? Because there's more power in 500 people showing up than there is in one.
Let me read an email from Todd. Due to the, and this is in quotations, terrific economy and the recession is over. Laugh out loud. I work as a nurse's aide and have for the last 2 years after being in management for the last 20 years, I feel that human service industry is entirely underpaid and I make less than someone who flips burgers, but I'm caring for human beings. What's wrong with this picture? And I'm seeing a lot of anecdotes that are very similar to that, Linda.
Yeah. That's because they're largely true, isn't it? you know, look, the service industry, there's retail and bars and hospitality and all sorts of different things, but the basis of the jobs are all the same. We're going to pay you as little as we legally can get away with, or we're going to pay you 10 cents above it so we can say we're not paying minimum wage. We're going to give you benefits where the deductible is so high it's not even worth the ridiculous amount of premiums we're charged, and then we're going to say you turned the benefits down, but we offered them. Mm. You know, those are going to be inherent to all of the service industry. You're going to work on your feet for 8 hours a day. You're going to get called in 10 minutes to spare, you're going to work 30 minutes, we're going to cut you and send you home because there's no customers. We don't have any duty of care to you, but you need to be responsive to us. We sign contracts that state for a part-time job that's guaranteed to not be over 20 hours a week, we will not work at any competitors. We will not get a second job without permission from our bosses. And if we do so, we violated our employment contract and can be fired.
And this is in the service industry.
In the same packet of documents, yeah. This is at a restaurant I'm talking about. In that same packet of documents, I had to sign an acknowledgement that I was working in an at-will state. There was no contract between us, and I could be fired at any time for any reason.
Mm. You talked about universal health care. Now, we don't have this in this country. We have the Affordable Care Act in its place. Has that in any way made life better for low-income Americans?
For millions, absolutely. Of course, it's not helping in the states that they don't have the coverage. It's not helping in the states that are not expanding Medicaid. It's certainly not helping in the states where you've got people who are actually going out of their way to undermine the closest thing we've ever had to single payer, just so that they can score political points off it. And that's coming from the right and the left both. I'm not, you know, casting any stones at one party here. But, you know, it is largely helpful in what we need to do. What we need to do is what the Heritage Foundation back in the 80s wanted to do and what Barack Obama not too many years ago wanted to do and go single payer. Mm. It's worked in every other Western nation. I don't understand why we can't wrap our heads around it.
Well, and I can't tell you how many programs we have done about that, and I don't have an answer either. But let me get to it. Looks like Rosalind from the Art Museum area here in Philadelphia to join the conversation. Hi, Rosalind. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. First of all, I definitely plan on reading your book. And I wanted to make a comment. I'm a teacher who realizes that school lunches are absolutely fundamental and necessary, number one. But I read several Studs Terkel books, and one of them was, I think, Hard Times on the Great Depression. which was very interesting. But I read another one called Either Work or Working, and one of the people he interviewed made the comment that poverty or being poor used to be a shame, and now it's perceived as a sin. So I think there's a moral aspect that is included that might make some people think, oh, I would never be poor because I am a moral person. And that's all I wanted to say.
Oh, Rosalind, it's a very interesting comment. Yeah, go ahead, Linda.
So the number of people that I have heard, and you can go on to any internet website, you can go onto the comments of probably this radio station if you guys post this as a podcast.
Yep, we do.
And find somebody that goes, well, if they would just quit smoking, if they just quit drinking, you know, the drugs, look at the drugs. We've got a welfare program, right? I want to say it was Arizona this time. And every single time we go to a state and they go, well, all of these people are welfare trash. All of these people are on drugs. They do extensive, invasive testing of all of these welfare recipients, and they come up with $600 in savings. $600 because 1% are going to drop dirty. That's 99% of the people who even qualify for welfare are not on drugs, but we are going to go ahead and judge them for that anyway.
But this idea that is somehow because you're sinful, that's why you're poor, you think that's a common idea today, Linda?
Oh, absolutely. If you would just save. If you just save instead of spending your money frivolously. Well, sweetheart, my rent is $475, and my biweekly, that is once every two paychecks or once every 2 weeks paycheck, is $250. So tell me where I'm supposed to be saving money. You explain to me. And every time I've had somebody come at me with that moral judgment, I say, okay, great, here was my life. You find me the wiggle room. Find me the one luxury that you can say I don't deserve. Tell me that everybody who's making a low wage in America should live a romanceless, aesthetic life with absolutely no small pleasures in it even because they need to make it to the next level. Tell me that in America, everybody has to value money and the getting of money so highly that they can't be the sort of person who wants to stay at home, just go to work, get the rent money, come home and hang out with their families. Tell me we don't value that, and then you explain to me again why. Hmm. Tell me why I am wrong for wanting a decent life for myself and my family, for why sometimes, yeah, when I was on food stamps, and I have been on food stamps, when it was my anniversary, I bought a steak. I don't apologize for that because once a year, you're allowed to have a steak in America. I don't care if it is more expensive than ground beef. You're allowed that one time. And for anybody to be able to say that that is untrue, that tells me that person has never lived an aesthetic life where you wake up on a crappy mattress with your back hurting and you open your eyes and the first thing you see is industrial white gray tin ceilings with a giant crack running through it and a cockroach coming out because your landlord won't maintain his buildings. Nobody that has ever lived that life ever would be able to say you don't ever deserve to have a nice thing. That is a moral judgment. That is a judgment of sin. And I refuse to accept that.
Rosalind, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Jewel from Glenside has to say. Jewel, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Linda. I just finished reading your book. Thank you so much for writing it. It was wonderful. I'm a college professor. My field is the field of nutrition. So I teach about hunger and food insecurity, and that's why I'm always interested in reading great books about the experience of poverty. I was intrigued that one of your chapters started with "My problem can't be solved by a spinach salad," So I was wondering if you could share your perspective on what I often feel is a patriarchal type of way that we try to get people on lower incomes to eat better.
Jewel, thanks. Yeah, sure. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Linda, go ahead.
So you got a few big questions in there. First, when you're talking about fresh and healthy food, you're talking about a stable life. If you're going to buy things that aren't shelf stable, if you're going to be talking about fresh food, you need to know that you're going to be home to eat them. If you're working two or three part-time jobs, you don't ever know when you're going to be home and when you're not. I have wasted so much money in my life buying lettuce or broccoli, and it goes to rot in the fridge because then I wound up having three super busy days and didn't get to them before they turned. So then you're talking about like canned and frozen, right? Okay, go to any major city in America, go to the low-income neighborhoods, find me the place that sells you frozen and canned vegetables instead of pizza in the freezer. You show them to me. Now, the second thing you got to worry about is it costs more to produce fresh food than shelf-stable food. So if you're going to tell the poor that they need to watch their pocketbooks, they need to not spend so frivolously, they need to not do things like buy lean meat. They should be buying, you know, hamburger at the Chuck instead. That's a 70-30, because that lean meat, that's for the rich people, not for you. If you're going to tell an entire class of people that, you cannot then turn around and say, why are you not eating more healthfully? Thirdly, if you're going to eat very well, and you're going to eat, I mean, look, I was in the restaurant industry. I've been a cook for a lot of years. I know how to cook food, right? But I know how to cook food. I was trained. If you're going to take people that have never been trained in how to deal with spices and how to deal with stuff, these are, you know, people, maybe they leave their parents' house, it's fairly middle class, they go to college, they fall in some rough times after. Tell me, when did they learn to cook, like real food from scratch? How many people in America know how to make pancakes from scratch without a recipe book? Not many, right? We have lost that culturally as a nation, that attachment to our meals. And then we've made it simply unaffordable for the poor to buy healthy food. So now you can't make it, you can't afford it. Why would you? Now, the third thing is all of this food, this terrible, terrible food, like the Cheetos and the, you know, nacho chips and the pizza rolls. My God, how many pizza rolls have I eaten in my life? And the 20-cent microwave burritos, they are full of chemicals that are addictive. We know this. Food, this convenience food, it's one of the very few things we get that nobody looks at us sideways for, that we can have that pleasure center. Because what happens when you get the salt and the sugar and all the chemicals is your brain actually lights up the pleasure centers. It's like anything else that gives you pleasure. And you know what's funny about a lifestyle that's nothing but work and obligation and how am I going to make my rent and do I get to sleep? I didn't get to sleep last night. Do I get to sleep tonight? And who's picking up my kid from the neighbor's house? And what happens if I don't get enough hours? How am I going to make that up? Do I need to call the electric company and tell them that I'm going to be late on my bill, or did I already do that? Or maybe my husband did it. I don't know. And in the middle of all of that, you can have a cheeseburger for a dollar. And it lights up the pleasure centers of your brain. Why would we give that up?
We're almost out of time here. We have an email from Gary saying, finally, someone who's speaking the truth and so well about what it's like to be poor. I'm a 71-year-old registered Republican. Call me a Rhina. But when I hear Linda, I have hope. Do you have hope, Linda?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Dude, do you know what I did for money in my day? I've gotten through a whole lot, and a lot of people have gotten through much worse. Hell, my husband went to Fallujah with the Marine Corps. We can fix some food policy in this country. That's just a matter of enough people figuring out that there's a problem and demanding a solution. And we're close. We're so close. Look, I shouldn't have a career. If we weren't close to change, nobody would have paid attention to what I wrote, much less let me write a book, much less have me on the radio a year and a half later. This is insane. The only reason this is happening is because so many people are in the same boat and paying attention. And I will say, Gary, you might be a rhino, but I got a Don Rumsfeld quote tattooed on my arm. So, honey, you and me both.
Fair enough. And Linda, we're almost out of time here. So do you have another book in the works? As you said, you're now a writer.
I've got like 20 of them. It turns out if you go, hey, you now do this for a living, go and do. You can. The thing that I've realized is how much I'm capable of that I never knew I was before, because I was always so busy and so tired and so exhausted. And more, you can't have hope. You cannot believe that you are better. You cannot believe that you have anything worthwhile if the market keeps telling you over and over and over again that you are wrong and everybody tells you the market is right. So suddenly people look at me and they go, you can be anything you want, and they mean it. They sent me to the London School of Economics, and I got to tell invisible hand jokes. Like, that was freaking amazing.
Linda, we have to end on that note. I'm sorry to do that. They're playing my song. Yeah, no, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Absolutely.
Linda Tirado, her book is called Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. Lots of comments here. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.